me start by introducing our distinguished panel, and then I'll say a few words about where we're going to go with this panel for the next hour or so. To my immediate left is Steve Smith, who's a partner with Jones Day in the San Francisco office. He's spent the last 33 years in his practice focusing on arbitration of complex international disputes, handled matters for and against sovereign entities, including the Middle East, Europe, Asia, Latin America, and he served as counsel and arbitrator in a number of different matters. Steve also was a lecturer in law at Stanford Law School, where he taught international commercial arbitration. So, thank you, Steve. To his immediate left is Katya Yannick-Small. Katya, in the program, you'll see she's listed as counsel with the international public international law groups at Sherman Sterling in Washington, D.C. She is no longer at Sherman Sterling in Washington, D.C. Katya is an independent counsel and an arbitrator. She has worked on a number of investor-state arbitrations and public international law issues, and is a lecturer of law at the USC's Gould School of Law, teaching here on this campus in the area of international investment law and arbitration. And finally, to Katya's left is Neil Popovich. Neil is a partner at Shepard Mullin Richter Hampton, also in San Francisco. He's the team leader of the firm's international litigation and arbitration team. Neil also teaches courses in international litigation and arbitration and international environmental law at UC Berkeley School of Law. So I want to thank my panelists for joining us today. Let me introduce our topic in the following way. 42 years ago at the inaugural Pound Conference in Minneapolis, which was a celebration of a speech that Roscoe Pound gave in, it must have been 1906, because it was 1976, and it was the 7-year anniversary of a speech that Roscoe Pound gave on the state of the judicial system, the dispute arbitration system in the United States. Chief Justice Warren Burger was the keynote speaker at that conference, the bicentennial of the United States, and Chief Justice Burger was commenting on, again, on the state of the judicial system and dispute resolution in the United States. Among other things, he commented on the fact that we have issues, inefficiencies, delays, and some of the concerns then that we still have in our court systems, both state and federal. And he advocated broader use of arbitration as a more efficient and more cost-effective method of dispute resolution. Since then, and even before then, many judges have cited to the liberal policy in the federal courts favoring arbitration agreements, and have spoken to and commented on the legislative history of the Federal Arbitration Act, which reflected Congress's view that arbitration constitutes a more efficient dispute resolution process than litigation. So we start from that premise. As we all know, much has been written over the last many years about how all this sort of wonderfully efficient, ideal process has gotten bogged down occasionally. The word that was, I think Tina's term was, I learned a new word today, litigationization. The litigationization of arbitration. But we've all read and know about the concerns that have been expressed by commentators, by arbitrators, by people in the field about inefficiency that has crept in, about the fact that the process has gotten bogged down in discovery. We talked about the possibility of appeals. Yes, I think it is fair to say that segments of the business community, certainly some of my clients who I talk to about arbitration versus litigation, are questioning whether arbitration is the most desirable form of dispute resolution today, and some have said they'd rather be in front of a judge in say a federal court, even given all of the warts and imperfections of that process. So, as advocates and arbitrators in the context of the international and domestic arbitration field, we would be remiss if we didn't look at some of these issues as we talked about today. Look for ways to preserve and enhance efficiency and economy and appropriate speedy resolution of disputes in the context of arbitration. And as was mentioned in Professor Michael Meadows' panel, We all need to be honest about some of the perceived problems that we've identified. We're willing to address and correct those. And I think it was Maria that described the battle between the arbitration field and the traditional litigation field as a turf war. And we need to be prepared to speak to those issues that are, again, causing concern about the arbitration process and addressing them. And then, as we've also heard today, these issues are informed by the concept and the subject of due process. And I'll talk a little bit about that. The due process necessarily impacts and informs our views on the practices that make the arbitration process both fair and efficient, because there's a balancing act there that we've all got to be mindful of. So what I'd like to do is turn now to our discussion about efficiency-enhancing techniques in international arbitration. We're going to talk through a number of different issues, some of which may be sponsored by the advocates, some of which have been both adopted and endorsed and implemented by arbitrators, and some of which have been built into some of the amendments to some of the arbitral systems rules that govern arbitration. So I'm going to turn it over now to Steve Smith.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. And I'm actually going to go off piste here a little bit, and I'd like to make a comment, particularly for the younger people in the room, about the origins of international arbitration in California, because it dates back to the beginning of my time as a practitioner. How many of you remember Warren Christopher? A lot of the older timers, but so he, you'll probably remember him most prominently as the Secretary of State in the first Clinton administration. But he was also the Deputy Secretary of State in the Carter administration. And he was the one, after Cyrus Vance resigned after the disastrous rescue attempt, that negotiated the release of the hostages, and that was part of what became the Algiers Accords. And it was all done through the good offices of the Algerian government, because the United States and Iran were not talking to each other. And part of the Algiers Accords was to establish the Iran-United States Claims Tribunal in The Hague. And when Warren Christopher came back to Amelia Myers in Los Angeles, he attracted a number of what we refer to as Iranian claims litigation cases. They were actually arbitrations before the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal. But since we weren't that familiar with arbitration, we actually referred to them as litigation matters. And so beginning in the early 80s, the large firms in Los Angeles, primarily O'Melveny and I believe Gibson Dunn, had a number of large international arbitrations before the Claims Tribunal in The Hague. And we did those for a number of years, and it's true, once those faded, there was a bit of a pause, but then we began to get more international arbitrations. In the later 80s, and by the beginning of the 90s, it was not unusual to have one or two international arbitrations in the firm at the same time that we added the international arbitration component to the New York office, and things began to really mushroom from there. So Warren Christopher was a USC undergrad, and he really was somebody responsible as a result of his role in government and negotiating the accords and the establishment of the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal for jump-starting the international arbitration practice in California. And not just in California, but when I talk to my colleagues in other firms, Covington and Burling, in Washington, Debevoise in New York, their senior practitioners in the international arbitration space also cut their teeth on the Iranian claims cases. And so that had just an enormous influence on the development of the practice, and it all began in the very early 80s, and Los Angeles was one of the epicenters for the practice. So I wanted you all, particularly at USC here in Los Angeles, got to know that history. So now I'll pivot and begin talking about the subject matter of this panel, which is how to enhance the efficiency of international arbitration. We're focusing on efficiency. I'm going to stray into effectiveness in a few areas, but I'd like to start by making a very trite proposition, which is the efficiency of your arbitration is going to be a function of your arbitration clause in first instance. And there's a number of things that you need to do in drafting the arbitration clause to ensure that the arbitration does not immediately become a procedural morass. And one of those is you need to make sure that the clause is drafted broadly to embrace all claims. It avoids drawing unnecessary jurisdictional lines. You need to avoid imposing specific requirements for arbitrator selection. This is a personal view. We have just experienced the problems with that in a case that we initiated in July of last year. We just now have a tribunal. In that case, the arbitration clause specified that the arbitrators all had to be bilingual in English and Spanish and also have 7 years of relevant industry experience. I generally am not in favor of specifying any qualifications in an arbitration clause. I think that if you have seasoned counsel, that one of the first judgments that they bring to bear on the process and establish their value is by choosing good arbitrators and participating in that process in a way that serves its clients' interests. So avoid that. It really did bog down the entire process. The whole issue of joinder and consolidation, where you have the prospect of multiple parties, multiple contracts, can be a conference unto itself. But just distilling that to its essence, if you have, for instance, a contract between an owner and an EPC contractor on a big project, and then the EPC contractor has subcontracts with the parties that are supplying, for instance, a steam turbine generator and other big pieces of equipment, and you want the ability to consolidate and join, you need to do two things. One, you need to have either rules that permit consolidation and joinder, or specify the ability for consolidation and joinder in both the arbitration clause in the prime contract and in the subcontract. And then the two contracts have to have near identical provisions or at least be compatible. And when I say compatible, I mean they need to have the same rules, the same arbitral seat, the same number of arbitrators, and usually the same substantive law. So if you have all of that, then you can have an arbitration where the owner brings a claim against the EPC contractor, and the EPC contractor wants to bring in the supplier of the steam turbine generator. The turbine generator suffered a catastrophic failure. And you would be able to do that if you set it up right. If you don't, then what happens is you have two parallel arbitrations. And that obviously is not cost-effective or efficient. You obviously want a broad choice of law provision. You should also choose the seat wisely so that it's in an arbitration-friendly jurisdiction in terms of not only legislation, but also the judiciary. And now with the development or establishment of hubs everywhere, that's much easier to do. And then I think it's advisable not to opt for ad hoc arbitration, but to arbitrate under an institution's rules where you have the benefit of its case management services. And also, there is some penalty imposed by the institution when granting compensation, particularly if you're in the ICC system, and I think they're very proud of this. They will actually diminish the arbitrator's pay if there's a perception that the arbitrator did not handle the arbitration in an efficient, cost-effective way.
Yes, there's a question.
What do you mean by broad choice of law provision?
Rather than have a choice of law provision in the contract that just simply says this contract shall be construed in accordance with the laws of the state of New York, what you would have is something like this contract and any and all claims arising out of this, you know, agreement shall be governed by New York law. And that way you can guarantee that the entire arbitration is going to be controlled by New York law. And you're not going to have a choice of law disputes that might require you, for example, to put in alternative cases under one possible law or another, depending on what choice of law rules are chosen. So there'd be a dispute over choice of law rules as well. It also avoids the necessity for having a preliminary proceeding over choice of law if the tribunal were to decide that.
So the difference between this contract shall be construed by fill in the blank and this contract and all things arising here under, it just means that for a tort claim, for example, I mean, there would be no debate about where what law you look to for non-contractual.
Yeah. So in, under some law, if it says arising out of this agreement, then that choice of law clause is limited to contractual claims. But if the clause says arising out of or in connection with or relating to this agreement, that's construed as not only embracing the contractual claims arising out of the agreement, but also any other claims as well. So you want to have a broad.
So in a sense, the broadness has to do with the scope of activity that might be involved, not the specific law that would be involved.
Well, it would be that either contract claims or tort claims or any other claims are governed by a single law. And there's no dispute as to what that law is because it's clearly specified in the agreement. So it avoids a lot of inefficient proceedings. So for structuring the agreement, I think it's also sensible up front to determine whether there's any way that you can decide issues or claims that are going to dramatically reduce the scope of the proceedings. I mean, it has to be an important claim, an important issue, and it has to have the effect of reducing the scope of further proceedings or laying the foundation for settlement. And you see this often with respect to jurisdictional issues, pivotal contract construction issues, and this also bleeds into the next bullet point, which is early disposal of important claims with obvious deficiencies. And we, in another case, are facing this issue because we brought a claim for compensation under an agreement, and the other side has counterclaim for defective work, among other counterclaims. And the problem with this counterclaim is that this is a huge project. A defective work claim could be extraordinarily messy, burdensome, and expensive. It's going to be driven by expert testimony and analysis, and it could be a very expensive sideshow. The problem with the counterclaim, though, is that the agreement provides an exclusive remedy in the event of defective work. And our client, under that remedial provision, has an absolute right to correct defective work so long as it's notified to our client. And then there's a process that the contract specifies. So the assertion of this counterclaim is in violation of the exclusive remedial provisions of the agreement. It doesn't meet a condition precedent to even asserting it. And so We are attempting to bifurcate the proceeding so that the defective work counterclaim can be resolved as a preliminary issue. Did the other party meet the contractual requirements for even bringing the claim? And of course, the party opposing the procedure will reflexively complain that it is being denied the full opportunity to present its case. And that may be the case where there are issues in the initial proceeding that are also issues that could spill over when determining the merits of a defective work claim. And if that's the case, if there's that commonality, then bifurcation is usually denied. But where that's not the case, and the claim can be cleanly killed on the basis of a threshold defense, then it is subject to early determination. It makes the proceeding much more efficient and cost-effective. And concerns about due process should really recede, because a party does not have a right to maintain a claim that is subject to a clean threshold defense, be it it's contractually it's barred by the statute of limitations, or some other defense of that nature. And then, of course, it may make sense to bifurcate liability of some damages. When that's done, it can often lead to settlement when you have a clear liability determination. Or it can guide the parties in the way that they present their damages cases. And so that also makes the case more efficient and effective. Okay, there's a, I think, a convention that's developing in international arbitration with respect to the procedure. And what it is it's four memorials, a claimant statement of case or opening memorial, there's different ways you can put it, the respondent's statement of defense, the claimant's statement of reply, and then the respondent's statement of rejoinder. And each submission usually, and I believe should for efficiency reasons, include all of the evidence that the party needs to support that submission. So in the first instance, to support that party's statement of case. So that should be, and this is very normal, as you know, witness statements would go in with the opening submission, expert reports, and all exhibits necessary to support the party's particular case. And when you look at this, you also need to consider very carefully where you would have document discovery. And if the claimant needs documents from the other side in order to prepare its submission, its opening submission, then that party would argue for the opportunity for document requests, for pound document requests, before the submission of the statement of case. Now, the respondent in that case may not want to make requests at that point. Instead, it may want to wait until it sees the claimant's statement of case before propounding its request for documents. And so it may want to have that before preparing the statement of defense. But in any event, different considerations will determine where in this rather conventional process the request for production of documents would fit. Okay, so there's been a lot of talk about discovery. For an efficient proceeding, I think most people, most practitioners would agree that you need to avoid American-style discovery. That means depositions, requests for admissions, interrogatories, things of that nature. But you also need to consider whether document discovery is even necessary. And in that connection, you really need to take into account the nationality of the other party and the lawyers that are representing that party, because they may have a legal culture and tradition, and also ethical norms that prevent the lawyers in the party from producing documents that are not in the party's interest, and certainly would not produce documents to the same extent that an American party would. And we had this situation in a case where we were representing an American company that purchased an extensive industrial processing line from a German company. And the German company installed it, commissioned it, and then the system did not live up to contractual specifications, and so there was a dispute that went to arbitration. And we ended up taking the position that no discovery, no document discovery was necessary, and the German counsel embraced that. And in our conversations with him, it became very clear that that was going to be, you know, a completely one-way street, that we were going to turn ourselves upside down responding to document requests provided by the German party. And the German party, which was not accustomed to producing documents, was going to do their best, but then the German lawyer also made it clear that there were ethical constraints on exactly what he would be able to produce, and so we decided to scuttle the whole process. And it resulted in a much more efficient and economical arbitration without, I think, a diminution in our ability to present our case. Okay, so document discovery. You can really get mired in a time-consuming and expensive process. There's ways to avoid that. Obviously, document discovery should be proportional to the needs of the case. It's, each case is unique. You have to come up with a bespoke procedure and approach to document requests. You should consider whether the IBA rules on the taking of evidence in international arbitration should apply. I usually, as a default rule, want Article 3 of the IBA rules and Article 9 to apply, not simply as guidance, but simply to apply to the document exchange process. And this is important because in the IBA rules, the requested documents, they have to be request specific documents for a narrowly tailored category, and they need to be, in addition to these other requirements, relevant and material to the outcome of the case. So the documents you're requesting, you need to show that they're material to the outcome of the case. And I find that a lot of American arbitrators are not sensitive to these requirements. And so although they'll accept the application of the IBA rules, sometimes, and you will craft a schedule for the arbitration, which is fairly expeditious as a result, because you're not expecting really extensive American-style requests, and you're not expecting to have to do the type of document review and production that you would, for example, in US litigation. There have been instances where we've adopted the IBA rules, everybody understands it's going to be narrow discovery, and then all of a sudden you get the American plaintiff's lawyer who gives you 77 requests, any and all documents relating to this contention, and you object, and the arbitrators grant 69 of them, but you only have 2 weeks to produce, because that's the schedule you agree to, thinking that the IBA rules would be adhered to. So, you need to impress on everyone that if the IBA rules are going to be adopted, they need to be applied as written, particularly if the schedule is going to take into account that that's what everybody is doing. Okay, let me talk a little bit about experts. And this is really more effectiveness than efficiency, because there's been a process has developed and to help arbitrators understand completely divergent expert opinions and to bridge the gap between them. So, for example, if the arbitrators are confronted with a very sophisticated damages calculation, there's four rounds of expert reports, and one expert says that through this discounted present value analysis, claimant is entitled to $330 million, and the other expert says, well, no, actually it's closer to $3. There's got to be a way for the arbitrators to figure out where in between the actual damages lie. And so there's a process that's developed that has the experts submitting their reports with the submissions that I just outlined, but also calling on them to meet and prepare a joint report identifying the areas of agreement and disagreement between them, and doing it in table form where they briefly explain their positions and then identify in their reports where the position is set forth, and also the key exhibits and the like. And then at the hearing, the experts testify not one after the other, but in confrontation to one another, what's called hot tub. And that only works effectively if you have an arbitrator, usually it's the chair, that can do the cross-examiner, the examination of the experts in tandem in a very effective way. And if that happens, then the arbitral tribunal will have identified the issues which it deems to be determinative in that particular area of expert testimony, and then will ask the experts questions in those areas, and then that examination is then followed by questioning by the claimant and then questioning by the respondent's counsel. And I've seen it done very well, usually by English QCs. And I've seen it done horribly well, but even if it's done horribly well, if your counsel can then examine the two experts in tandem, they can usually pick up the slack.
Help us with the concept of horribly well.
Horribly well.
Horribly well, yeah. What does that mean?
Horrible.
Horrible.
Well, no, I mean, the QCs do it. Okay.
Are you just saying you've seen it done well, you've seen it done horribly well?
I'm sorry. I've seen it done well, and I've seen it done horribly.
Okay, got it.
yeah, almost not at all. Sorry about that.
Let me pause it for a second. I mean, I'm not a big fan of this process. I've seen it. I've tried it. It hasn't been very successful. How many of you have worked with experts for these sort of joint meetings and these schedules? And so, Judge, successful? It worked well?
Yeah, I think it works when the parties want it. I mean, you just got to have a situation where the parties want it. I've frequently raised it as a possibility, but it's infrequent that the parties actually want it. It works best, I think, when the experts are allowed to testify without a record, literally, as an educational process before the hearing begins, and the lawyers sit on the side. They're not allowed to ask any questions or interrupt. And the two experts just talk to the tribunal about some very arcane scientific, usually, issue. And we're extremely wrong.
Two points on that. One is, in my experience, the tribunals now are instructing the lawyers not to be involved in the joint meeting.
Not even there?
Not in the joint meeting. So the joint meeting is between the experts alone. And the second technique that's been developed out of this is that the tribunal asks the experts to give about an hour presentation each before they're actually hot. And so we had an arbitration in Australia recently, and we spent an enormous amount of time preparing these presentations for the tribunal, and I think that was very effective.
I think also, Steve, that the British rule, I think, has caused the expert testimony process to be improved immensely. And we have not adopted anything like that, which is incomprehensible to me why we haven't, because our lawyers know about the British rule, and the British rule has been adopted in Australia and other British Commonwealth countries. And it just makes the expert process so much more honest and direct and narrowly targeted. It's really a disgrace that we haven't adopted what you described there in principle what the British do.
Right, and in that case also the arbitrator or the experts are instructed to be essentially servants of the tribunal and not for the parties or the council. And so that does generate a degree of candor that you might not otherwise have.
You don't. Yeah, anyone who's put on an expert in a British and a London-based arbitration compared to what you do with experts in the United States, I mean, it is night and day. The experts have a very different view of the process, and those that work in the London and British system are remarkably ethical about their obligation to be sort of there for the tribunal, for the fact finder, as opposed to being a voice for the advocate for the party.
The other thing that goes along with that I think is not necessarily obvious until you see it in action is when you have an expert on one side who's used to testifying in U.S. cases, and then a European expert, say, who does a lot of tribunal work, the approach is very different. So I once saw two experts of such description. The European expert, in cross-examination, was not just saying yes or no, was taking the question, because there was hot tubbing, but they were individually cross-examined first and then put into the hot tub to talk about their areas of disagreement, which is how I've seen that done. And was more, the approach was to teach the tribunal what they needed to know. Whereas the American expert was in defensive mode on cross, yes, no, yes, no. And the feel for that expert was that it just wasn't helpful. Like, you actually couldn't figure out how that was different from what you were getting from the other side. It was very awkward to watch this. And then they got put in the hot tub. And the American expert did very well. Totally changed his demeanor when he was interacting with his fellow expert, as opposed to taking questions from counsel. And that's something I think that as counsel you need to prepare your expert for, especially if they're not used to that process, that the tribunal is trying to find, like it's a fact-finding mission. They want the right answer. So I'm gonna put a hired gun on and give you my side, if it doesn't make sense, is not gonna get you anywhere at the end of the day. They're just gonna have to reject it, because you can't figure out which parts of this you take, which parts of that you don't. You can't, you know, it's expertise. So
it's a very difficult decision for an arbitrator who is not familiar with the experience of counsel appearing before her or him to even suggest that there be a hot tubbing procedure in lieu of cross. Because with the exception of arbitrators like yourself, Steve, and all of you on the panel who have been exposed to this and know how it works and can, in the coffee break or whatever, talk to your clients favorably about the hot tubbing process, the instinct of the common law lawyer, the American arbitration advocate, is going to be that I do not want to give up the right of cross-examination. Maybe you can do this as the tribunal's method of examination when we get to the tribunal's questions. So it's a big step if you don't have counsel before you who you can anticipate being comfortable with the process rather than seeing it as an encroachment on their turf.
Yeah, well, usually it's both. In my experience, the hot tubbing, the examination by the arbitrators and then the follow-on cross by counsel, and the difference in the demeanor of the American expert is really a function of who's asking the question. So if it's the opposing counsel, yes, that expert is trained to be in a very defensive mode, but then if the arbitrator interjects with a question, then all of a sudden the demeanor changes, and then the expert becomes much more helpful. And so that's why I always think it's better to have the hot tubbing exercise with the tribunal questions first, and then have the follow-up with counsel, and you preserve the right for cross-examination that many American lawyers find essential to the process. So let me move really quickly to hearings and just say a couple things. This is all premised on the testimony coming in writing with the submissions that I outlined. And if you do that, you can obviously limit the hearing testimony to minimal direct, introducing the witness, having the witness affirm his or her written testimony, essentially warming the witness up a little bit, and then turning the witness over to opposing counsel. And then you have cross and then redirect, and the redirect is limited to the scope of cross. Let me say this about opening statements. I find opening statements in the American tradition are not particularly helpful. If it's just giving a roadmap, this is who you're going to hear from, this is why this person is important, I think you're really missing an opportunity. I think it's important to make sure that the tribunal understands your case so that it has an analytical framework fresh in its mind for hearing the testimony that it is about to receive. And David Karen, who unfortunately died about 3 weeks ago at the age of 65, he was a member of the Iran U.S. Claims Tribunal. He was sitting by designation on the ICJ. He was still teaching at King's College after leaving Berkeley and being a colleague of Neil's for so many years. He's somebody I've used as an arbitrator. We were in the same class at Berkeley Law. And he was in San Francisco and spoke at an event of the Northern California National Arbitration Club. And afterward, I talked to him about how best to present your case before an English tribunal, because I was about to do that for three very imminent QCs. And he told me that he found American-style advocacy in international arbitration to be not as effective as English-style advocacy, both with respect to the closing opening statement and also the closing argument. And he thought that it was much more helpful to start out by taking the tribunal through your case and going through the contract, and then we have the bundles and say, keep your thumb on, tab 1, but now I want you to flip to tab 20, and here is language that I want you to focus on. And walking the tribunal through the key contractual issues, the key documents, the key arguments, and not simply using the opening as a roadmap. And also not using the closing simply as an argument. And I have now adopted that approach because I do think it's more effective in ensuring, particularly in complex cases, that the tribunal understands the case. And I really credit him with that revelation on my part. If closings are required, I think it's helpful to have some time between the close of the testimony and the closing argument. So if you end on a Friday, say, and the tribunal is closing, have the closing on Monday or Tuesday. Some cases where the closing has been divorced from the hearing by about 30 days, and it really allows the tribunal to gear up for the closing, to deliberate, really determine what are the tough issues that need to be decided, and then to have counsel address those. And then if you're thinking about having post-hearing briefs in lieu of an oral closing, then I think it's helpful to have maybe take some time and specify the issues that they in particular want you to address. And that not only is more efficient, but I think it also is more effective.
I understand why the opening might be more than a roadmap. Can you say a little bit more about what the closing would be if it's not an argument?
Well, it would be similar, but what you would do is you would remind the tribunal of the key contractual provisions, for example, but then what you would do is you would go through the hearing testimony very carefully and explain how the hearing testimony supports your case. And so it wouldn't just be an argument, it would be tied very closely, tightly to the evidence, to the record.
Thank you.
Steve, also could you mention a little bit more about your preferences between oral closing and written posterior briefs, and what you think counsel prefer, what you think arbitrators prefer?
I think it really depends on the arbitrators and the counsel. And also, if you've taken the opportunity to give your closing as an opening, then the tribunal may simply want posterior briefs. They sort of heard your closing. They've got the PowerPoint presentation with all of the citations to the record and pictures of the documents and drawings and whatnot that you use as you walk them through the bundles. And in that circumstance, with the hearing testimony, they're thinking about the case may be sufficiently developed that they don't want an oral closing. In which case, hopefully, they're in a position to identify, you know, the items, the issues that they wish you to address in a written closing, in a post-hearing brief.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks. Let me pass the microphone over to Neil, who's going to address whether some of the efficiency enhancing techniques we talked about and we've heard about work.
Thank you, Steve. So I'm going to start, since it's already 10 after 4, I'm going to try and be efficient myself. What do we mean when we talk about efficiency? Saving time and saving money, but not just saving time and saving money in the abstract. Saving time and saving money while preserving quality. And what do we mean by quality? Decisions that are substantively likely to be correct in terms of law, in terms of the facts, and that satisfy the parties in the sense that they resolve an entire dispute. And so built into that is some tension between efficiency and some of the higher values of international arbitration. And some of the very tools that are designed to enhance efficiency carry with them the risk of reducing efficiency, because many of the tools, such as consolidation or bifurcation or summary disposition, they, in the first instance, add a layer of procedure, because that there is some procedure where you decide, is the case, are the issues going to be bifurcated? Will more than one arbitration be put together? Is there a reason to resolve the case short of full hearing? That means the parties have to present written submissions, and typically there will be some argument about those issues as well. And so evaluating the tools of efficiency requires thinking carefully about whether that tool is in fact going to ultimately advance the resolution of the case, or whether it's just another layer. And that also introduces the opportunity for abuse, sometimes by counsel, particularly if one side has more resources than the other. Adding layers means the other side is going to exhaust its resources, and there's sometimes a perception that that gives you a tactical advantage. But the kind of the ultimate check against overdoing the efficiency is what's already been referred to, due process, because that, if you think about what are the things that can undo an arbitration award, due process is a powerful one. So that means if there is ultimately a trade-off between efficiency and due process is almost always going to win. Kind of at the extreme, you can look at it in terms of procedures that truncate an arbitration, international arbitration, so that it's something short of full presentation of papers, full oral arguments. At what point does the elimination of procedures that you would normally do, steps you would normally take in an arbitration, mean that that arbitration is really no longer an international arbitration? You think of the New York Convention. The New York Convention applies to international arbitration, but that international arbitration has to have certain qualities in order to qualify so that awards will be recognized and enforced, and that the arbitration actually resolves a dispute between the parties. So if you think about the different tools, I think it's important to kind of delve into those tools and examine what aspects of those tools can increase efficiency and how can you protect against those tools being used to decrease efficiency. So for example, bifurcation of jurisdictional questions. That adds a step because in your request for bifurcation, you have to give a preview of your challenge to jurisdiction. And so if it is a good faith challenge and there is a kind of a way to separate jurisdictional issues from other issues, then it may in fact enhance efficiency. But if instead it means that you will have a proceeding about whether to bifurcate, and then if there's bifurcation, you'll have a proceeding about a jurisdictional objection, and then in the end the tribunal decides that jurisdiction and the merits are too intertwined to separate them, then you address jurisdiction yet again at the merits stage. Similarly with consolidation, there are pros and cons. There are things about consolidation that, as Steve pointed out, can significantly enhance efficiency because rather than multiple proceedings, you have one. But it doesn't always work that way. You have to think through, is one part of the dispute very simple, another part very complicated, so the party with the simple aspect of the dispute then gets dragged along in the longer, slower, more expensive arbitration. If the parties aren't identical, then sometimes one party is just kind of listening to a part of the dispute that it doesn't really care about. And they've got to pay their lawyer to be there for the hearing. And sometimes you have very technical issues. For example, if you have a contractor-subcontractor relationship, there may be different confidentiality obligations among the different parties, and you can get really complicated hearings where some parties are allowed to hear or see some testimony but not other testimony because of those relationships. So that doesn't mean you should do consolidation or you shouldn't do bifurcation, but you should think about those things in terms of how they will, in the context of a particular case, are they likely to enhance efficiency or do they risk slowing things down? And then the kind of the ultimate truncation, which Katya is going to talk more about, is some kind of summary disposition. And again, that can enhance efficiency greatly if it resolves a case without many otherwise necessary steps in the process. But if instead it's just kind of a way to try out some argument or a way to add a procedural burden to the other side, then it has the opposite effect from increasing efficiency. So how do you maximize the likelihood that you'll get the benefits and not get the possible collateral effects that result in inefficiency rather than efficiency? Well, it's up to all the participants in an arbitration. So that means counsel, and counsel not just at the stage of after a dispute arises, but as Steve noted, at the drafting stage. It's very important for counsel to think about efficiency. And some of that has to do with eliminating ambiguities in an arbitration. We're all trained as lawyers, and whenever we see ambiguity, we see something to fight about. And so if you reduce the ambiguities, whether it's how arbitrators are selected, or the choice of law clause, or some other substantive part of the agreement between the parties, then you reduce the number of things that the parties can fight about and presumably get them more quickly to resolution of the merits. Counsel also have an obligation and opportunities at the advocacy stage. They have ethical obligations not to make preliminary challenges or use some of these tools in a way that is just to get a tactical advantage. But they also have an obligation of zealous advocacy. So if they do think in good faith that they'll get an advantage by using some procedural tool, then they should be thinking creatively and trying to use those tools to their client's best advantage. It's also very important which arbitrators you choose. Some of that has to do with what traditions they come from. Some of it has to do with whether they are former judges who focused perhaps on case management, maybe didn't focus on case management, and what is the legal tradition or the judicial tradition that they come out of And how bold are they? How self-confident are they that if they agree to some truncated procedure, they will still yield an enforceable award? Do they have the courage of their convictions that this is a fair way to resolve a case short of a full hearing that doesn't deprive a party of due process? And most important in that choice, the choice of the presiding arbitrator. And I have had cases where the presiding arbitrator just keeps everybody in line and questions any procedural suggestion that a party makes and says, how is this going to get us more quickly to the final resolution? And then I've had other presiding arbitrators who just kind of want to sit and listen for a while and let things play out because they'd rather have a full record, and that can sometimes unnecessarily multiply the proceedings. So as counsel, you have the opportunity and the obligation, both to your client and I would say to the system of arbitration, to pick and choose the tools of efficiency and use them in good faith and in ways that are calculated to, that you don't have to have complete certainty, but calculated to enhance efficiency. And when they do, you can use them as zealously as you're able. But to avoid kind of the either reflexive or overly tactical use of some kind of theoretically efficiency-enhancing tools. And one example where I've seen that increasingly is in investor-state arbitration. It is almost a matter of course that there is a jurisdictional objection in many cases. And that doesn't mean there isn't a basis to challenge jurisdiction, but it also doesn't mean that imposing or interposing a jurisdictional objection is necessarily going to enhance efficiency, because in many of those cases, the issues are so complicated that it is not possible or not realistic to address jurisdiction completely independently of the merits, and tribunals are very wary of making a decision that touches on the merits without a full record. So in the interest of time, I'm going to defer to Katya unless there are questions.
Any questions? All right, it's 4:20, started a little bit late, so I'm going to cut these extra few minutes after 4:30, but we'll wrap up.
I have the most difficult task of all, the last one, to keep you all awake. I will very briefly discuss the fate of frivolous and meritorious claims, or in other words, early dismissal of meritorious claims. I will discuss it from the investor-state perspective and the commercial arbitration perspective. And we'll start with the procedures available under the different international investment agreements and international arbitration rules. And to address on a preliminary and expedited basis claims that are frivolous, but in the sense of being baseless and unmeritorious regardless of claimant's motives. And then try to have a conversation on advantages and concerns and have a discussion if possible. Let's see. The summary disposition, early disposition, has been seen in the US and English courts, however, much less in international arbitration. And the current trend towards this consideration of a request that an application be dismissed is rooted in the 2004 model bilateral investment treaty and the 2006 amendment to the ICSID rules, Rule 41.5. There is also an emerging focus on this summary disposition in international arbitration rules, traditionally concerned with commercial arbitration. Both the 2004 and 2012 U.S. model VATs, which are the starting point of the United States investment negotiations, provide procedures to address that as a matter of law, a claim submitted can be early dismissed. As such objection is to be decided on an expedited basis, with the tribunal suspending any proceedings on the merits and issuing its decision no later than 180 days after the objection was made. This development is largely attributed to the U.S.'s experience in the NAFTA case, Methanex. So in that particular case, the U.S. failed to convince the tribunal that it had authority to rule on the preliminary objection that the claim should be dismissed for lack of legal merit. In this case, the tribunal, it took the tribunal 3 years to come to this conclusion. And following this case, in all of its subsequent investment agreements, the U.S. has negotiated expedited review mechanisms that permit the respondent state to assert preliminary objections in an efficient manner. Canada FIPA, which is the equivalent of the bilateral investment treaty in Canada, provides for these preliminary objections. CAFTA, which is the Central American Free Trade Agreement also. And the 2016 CETA, which is the Canada-European Union Trade Agreement, also provides for these procedures. What is new in the CETA agreement is that it takes the approach to discourage frivolous claims by providing that the tribunal shall order the cost of the proceedings to be borne by the unsuccessful party. Otherwise, usually agreements provide for the tribunal may require the unsuccessful party to pay the cost. In this case, it shall. One of the first institutions to address the issue is ICSID in its rule 41.5, which is empowers to an ICSID tribunal to dismiss a claim in expedited proceedings. The development and introduction of this article began in parallel with the U.S. model VAT. And these two regimes are well aligned, and there is the ICSID rule provides that it can be triggered unless the parties have agreed to another expedited procedure, such as included in an investment agreement. There is a language of ICSID rule 41.5. I will not read it. It is a pretty structured procedure. A request has to be made no later than 30 days after the constitution of the tribunal, and in any event before the first session. And the tribunal, after giving the parties the opportunity to present their observations, shall at its first session or promptly thereafter notify the parties of this decision. So it's a very quick procedure. It's a procedure, however, that involves exchange of pleadings. And it can be regular procedure. So it adds an extra layer to the proceedings. Now the other institutions there have been a number of cases under ICSID rule 41.5. The first tribunal was the Transglobal against Jordan. And this tribunal decided how to interpret the phrase manifestly without merit for the claim. And the tribunal concluded that the ordinary meaning of the word manifest requires the respondent to establish its objection clearly and obviously with relative ease and dispatch. The standard is very high. So indeed, the standard is very high to prove that there is the claim is without merit. The second tribunal to look into this was Brandes against Venezuela. And was the first tribunal to consider and decide affirmatively that the rule applies to both jurisdictional and merits objections. The two successful objections were in the case of global trading against Ukraine, where the tribunal dismissed all of the claims. After it concluded that the commercial transactions at issue were not investments, and those claims were manifestly without legal merit. The tribunal in RSM against Granada dismissed the claims and was the first which awarded costs against the successful claimant, identifying Granada for all its costs. In the eight decisions that were issued since, no tribunal had dismissed all of the parties' claims as a preliminary objection. Also, ad hoc committees have confirmed that the rule 41.5 applies in annulment proceedings as well. The most international arbitration rules do not contain expedited procedures to address frivolous claims, and the question has been whether this will be permitted under these rules, for instance, FCIA, ICC. And in order to provide clarity regarding the procedure, some institutions have begun to include relevant provisions in their rules and or issue guidance confirming the possibility of use of the procedure under their existing rules. Absent specific rules or guidance, many arbitrators were very reluctant to use it, given the risk of due process challenges against their work. The Singapore International Arbitration Center was the first traditionally focused on commercial arbitration, now includes in the rules procedures to address early dismissal. Both in the commercial rules and also in the 2017 investment arbitration rules includes this possibility. The Stockholm Chamber of Commerce revised arbitration rules also include this procedure. And ICC only a few months ago issued a high-level guidance as a confirmation that the Article 22 of the ICC rules on the conduct of arbitration provides for expeditious determination of one or more claims or defenses on grounds that such claims are manifestly devoid of merit. As a reminder, the Article 22 requires that tribunals conduct the arbitration in an expeditious and cost-effective manner. Although this practice, practice guidance includes this practice includes guidance as to how the procedure should be conducted, it has been reluctant to be prescriptive and to how and under which circumstances this summary dismissal is possible. It leaves issues for development through practice, such as there's no appropriate timing for the filing of the application, there's no time limit to the tribunal's decision, there's no clarification of the substantive criteria to be used by the tribunal to define a claim or defense as manifestly devoid of merit. But the new guidance may help to avoid disagreements on whether or not it is within a tribunal's jurisdiction under the rules to apply summary procedure. And in turn, this may help to avoid challenges to any awards made on summary basis. In essence, the extent to which there is summary dismissal under the rules will depend heavily upon the composition of the tribunal in any given time, and arbitration, in particular, the procedural robustness of the tribunal in question. There is also considerable latitude for parties and tribunals to interpret the scope and application of the Article 22 differently. And it would be interesting to follow the exercise of this particular power in practice. What are the advantages of such a procedure? It enhances the efficient resolution of the dispute. It is cost effective. It is time effective. It increases the appeal of arbitration for users concerned that arbitration would not provide the proportionate means of dealing with straightforward disputes. It may encourage an early settlement agreement. There are, however, concerns that it could be a delay tactic. The frequent use of such procedures may exacerbate rather than alleviate the problems of delay and extra expense. Could be there could be a reluctance of the tribunal to dismiss a claim early for fear of challenge of the award due to lack of due process, although it would be less in cases where arbitration rules specifically provide. But the this could be limited by the tribunal offering granting the responding party a fair opportunity to present the case, and also if it states the reason for dismissing the case. The cost and the time savings advantage, there is a balancing act with the likelihood of success and the potential risks. The drafting of the arbitration clauses are as always important if the parties want to exclude the possibility of a summary dismissal. Also, the choice of arbitrators will are based on their their legal background would make them more or less inclined to allow such a procedure. So, yes.
Well done.
If there are any questions?
Questions? I have one quick question. That is the provision that requires, as opposed to makes it, as opposed to making it optional for the award of costs to the unsuccessful party. Does that mean that the party that brings a motion to exclude a claim because it is manifested without merit bears the risk of costs if that motion?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So it moderates both part, both
right.
sides'
exactly.
behavior, which is good. Which
yes.
is good.
Yeah. All right. We are at the end of a very long but productive day, and we thank Steve and his panel for.